So why are we working with dental providers around domestic violence? Well, it's such an epidemic, and not just our country, but worldwide. It's 1 in 3 out of women and 1 out of 4 gay men who've experienced some form of physical or sexual abuse by an intimate partner. There's also just worldwide studies from Australia, Canada, Israel, South Africa, and the U.S. show that 40 to 70% of female murder victims are killed by their husbands or boyfriends who are in abusive relationships. So, again, it's a major epidemic. 65 to 70% of the injuries result from abuse occurring in the region of the head, neck, and or mouth. It's associated with numerous physical and mental health issues. And physical and sexual abuse as a child or adult result in many forms of trauma and dental fear. So when people talk about how, you were saying, was that the second reason people don't come to the dentist? Fear is a big, a trauma-related fear, especially, you know, when the mouth is injured. And also, we're working with dental providers more because some of the behaviors and the tactics that batterers use to control their victim is around health care, particularly dental care. Survivors of abuse have a need for sensitive and quality dental care, yet may face many barriers due to fear and inability to access services. Dental providers are not typically educated about intimate partner abuse, which doesn't leave you. I mean, there's a lot of providers that aren't educated on this. They treat many of the injuries inflicted by abusive partners, but they don't recognize those injuries as coming from abuse. And again, they play a critical role in the healthcare response to domestic violence. So what we ended up doing is working with a couple of the programs that are in Boston, one in particular, the Asian Women's Task Force. And we wanted to do that because we knew that we had gone to a couple of conferences, and a few dentists had come, dental students had come up to us and said, you know, we don't get any kind of training in our curriculum. And we just happened to be with the women from the Asian Women's Task Force, and we were having this discussion. And they said, you know, maybe you should come into our class and bring a battered woman in and put her on a panel, whatever. But one of the things that the Asian Women's Task Force said to us was that you need to do some cultural competency around this as well. So we've collaborated with them. This was back in 2001, 2002. And then we started to do, the first clinical training was for the third year dental students in 2002. And then the other way that we did this too is that we sought funding, and we had Delta Dental, which gave us funding around this event, program, because we also wanted to service the women that that were in need, particularly from the programs, the shelter programs. So between 2004 and 2007, we've been working with Delta Dental, the three battered women's programs in Boston, and providing this training for the students, for first, second, and third year students. So the first year, what we do is, it's a lecture. I think it's about 45 minutes, and we look at the types of violence and abuse, look at the family, intimate partner, and sexual abuse. We look at the health consequences of violence in general, and then the role that the healthcare providers have in responding. Around the extent and types of violence, we talk about family violence in particular, but we also talk about community violence and institutionalized violence, including civil war and other violence among nations. We talk about this war that's going on now. Family, intimate partner, and sexual abuse often co-occur, so we really want them to know that when they're working with a client who discloses that they really have to look at her whole family, not just herself. It occurs in private. There's a lot of shame and isolation, and there's threats that are key factors in keeping victims trapped. We really focus on how victim blaming is very common. Perpetrators are not held accountable as with other types of crimes, and so many victims are reluctant to disclose. And then we talk about who this happens to. There's multiple forms of oppression in the U.S. intersect, increasing risk for women, people of color, particularly African American, Native American women who had the highest rates of domestic violence in this country, older women, girls, older men and boys, people with disability, LGBT folks, poor, homeless immigrants. We talk about the intersection with family and interpersonal violence and sexual assault, which occurs around the world. No one's immune, and so we just talk more about it's not isolated to to the United States or to Boston, that this is really a worldwide phenomenon. These, again, some more rates of the violence and abuse that are among women. And how they're linked to poor health for women. You were talking about the HIV clients that you have who don't seek treatment. Well, many women who are in abusive relationships don't go to their primary care provider even when they're pregnant, much less when they're having dental care or dental problems. I'm a survivor myself, and I have had a bridge in my mouth for about 20 years, and my whole thing is about fear going back. And then having to talk to the provider again, although my partner has passed away 20 years ago. But to bring that up again, so again, even women that aren't in abusive relationships, what they're women who are, or victims who are have a history of abuse and trauma, it continues through their life for many of these women because they get no services and really don't get any support services around this. And so some of the health effects of abuse are homicide and suicide, of course. But there's also maternal, infant mortality and morbidity, death from injuries or other health consequences, physical injuries, disability, depression, anxiety disorders, PTSD, chronic pain, intestinal and neurological disorders, reproductive health problems, STD, HIV infection, alcohol and drug dependency, because for a lot of these survivors, self-medication is key. Eating disorders and difficulty in accessing health care. There's injuries to the teeth, soft tissue, jaw, face, head, neck, STDs, difficulty eating, dependency on pain medication, non-compliance, negligent of oral hygiene, and dental fear resulting from trauma as a child or an adult. In the second year, we talked to them around intimate partner violence, how it's a public health problem. We do definitions and prevalence of interpersonal violence. We talk about the different types of abuse, the dynamics of the abusive relationships, cultural considerations, and this is where we bring in the Asian Women's Task Force, and they do wonderful role play and a survivor that comes in and talks with the students. We talk about the role of the dentist. So some of the examples of the abuse and control tracts is, of course, physical, overt, or threatened against the victim or others. The emotional and verbal abuse, which includes isolation, humiliation, intimidation, and deprivation. And emotional and verbal abuse is probably the most insidious of all because it really happens in the relationship all along. And for so many of these relationships, it never gets to the physical because the emotion and verbal is so effective that you don't have to go to the physical. It's when a partner leaves or threatens to leave that a physical abuse becomes dangerous even. Sexual abuse is very common, and that's another reason that a lot of women or people that we have seen in the clinics not coming for their oral health because they have been raped and orally raped, and when they get into the chair, it's very traumatizing for them. It brings back a lot of memories for them. And then there's also financial abuse, which interferes with work, school, and ruining credit. So what happens in an abusive relationship? We talk to them about that a lot, about how for a lot of the students, of course, some of the first questions they say, well, if it's so bad, she would leave. It can't be that bad. But actually what happens is that as you begin the relationship, it's there's, again, very low emotional abuse or even verbal abuse. It happens very subtly, and it doesn't because it doesn't start with violence right away in many relationships. You tend to think that, oh well, it's my fault. A lot of self-blaming, and people tend to stay a little longer because, of course, there's a lot of fear involved, but also a lot of I'm not going to do it again. I'm so sorry. I'll start going to AA. We'll start seeing your mother. So when that starts to happen, you think, oh, yeah, there's the guy I fell in love with. He's wonderful again, and everything will be fine. But eventually what's going to happen is that you're going to come up to another incident in any form, and then it starts all over again. But a lot of women do not feel that Well, they just don't feel that it's going to get any worse. And it's usually because they're so isolated in the relationship that they don't understand how fearful they are. Many of the women that we've talked to that have come to talk to the students will say, oh, I knew him so well, I knew that he wouldn't kill me or my children. And then they'll say, but then I saw the news, or I knew a friend, and this happened. And then they start to think that, yes, it could happen to me. But it takes a lot of support around them. So many of these women are isolated that they don't get that support. So, again, we talk about why victims stay. So, really and truly, it's a myth that women don't leave. We leave all the time. You come back because of fear of retaliation from the abuser, loss of benefits if you have immigration status or for yourself or your children. And, of course, there's love, hope. She's very confused. There's a lot of shame involved. And they believe that it is their fault. If I was just a better person, this wouldn't happen. A lot of the women that we've worked with don't have the right information. They're unaware of their legal rights and resources. Of course, financial, physical, and social dependence on the abuser sometimes. There's a lot of societal and family pressure to stay in the relationship, especially if there's religious factors involved. Fears and barriers related to racism, homophobia. Many of the gay clients that we've worked with are reluctant to come forward because not only are they going to have to say that they are in an abusive relationship, but that they're gay. And if they're closeted, it's a very difficult step to take. And then there's co-occurring health and trauma-related issues. A lot of victim blaming. And there's a lack of viable options. For every woman that we shelter in Massachusetts, we turn five away on a daily basis. I don't know what that is. Oh, these are the programs that we've worked with. And these are all of the different... sorry about that. I was going to show you that. So we've worked with all of these programs with the Boston Public Health Commission, and we're so excited to be working with Tufts around this. And I was, as we were getting ready to present this, we thought, oh, we should look at the other universities, see what they're doing. And nobody else is. Tufts is the only one that's doing this, so it's got to get on the ball. The third year, we start to address intimate partner violence in the dental setting, and this is where students can ask questions and do some role-playing with screening. And we use a DVD from the Family Violence Prevention Fund, which is free, and you can get it on their website. And they have a really nice tutorial around this. So we also talk about what the role will be and how to recognize the signs of abuse and inquire direct and safe if it's appropriate. We all always remind them that they never ask if the partner is in the room. But what's happened with this program is that they're actually seeing women that are already in shelter that are looking for services. So they get to practice with the women, but they also get to talk to the women about what would make them more comfortable about being in the chair, and validate the patient's experience, document objective findings, provide information, support, and referrals. And that's a tough one. It's even hard for primary doctors. They don't want us to take any more time away from their clinic time, appointment, because it's so little. Like, you know, when you're in a doctor, what do you see for 15 minutes? And so then if she just closes, providers are like, you know, I've got to get all these shelters or these resources. And a lot of times women don't want that. But it's good to know what there is out there in case this comes and a woman says, yes, I would like some support. Also to treat injuries and other health effects resulting from the violence and abuse, and learn techniques to lessen the negative impact of the dental visit on patients who may have trauma-related fears. The role of the dentist is not to stop the violence or save the victim, and that goes right away. That happens in the first year. They want to know what to do. Should they call the police when the woman's in the chair? Tell the patient that she should do or judge the patient for choices he or she makes. Violate the patient's privacy and confidentiality, except as required by law, and that is if children are being abused. In California, I think you can report a battery. A primary doctor can report a batterer, but I don't know how good that's going. A lot of women are not disclosing in California because they don't want their partner to go to jail. So trauma-informed guidelines for all patients. Assess the patient's fear. Consider whether fear has ever interfered with their oral health. Be aware of the potential for flashbacks and the triggers of PTSD, in particular the post-traumatic stress disorder. Ask patient what you can do to make him or her more comfortable. Allow the patient maximum control of exam procedures and communicate. Talk with your patients. for patients in a current abusive relationship in addition to the previous slide. Consider whether abuse or fear might be associated with current health issues, including the ability to keep appointments. The dentist gets so upset when you miss your appointment, but you don't know. Something might have happened with her that she was not able to get that for whatever reason. A lot of times, especially when you're coming out of the relationship, many of these women are stalked. So they, if they're nervous about coming to the dentist or anywhere, even leaving their house, they may miss an appointment. Schedule follow-up appointment, particularly if she discloses an accessibility to follow treatment plan. Allow for flexibility. Remind staff of safety protocols and policies regarding who comes into the exam room, sharing information about appointments, billing, reminder, phone calls. Because batterers are very clever, and sometimes they will call the doctors to find out if their partner is there. And again, that you have to look at the survivor's perspective, what is important for her to feel comfortable in the chair, and talk about some of the training goals for students, and we do that with them, like what would be your goal if you had a woman in the chair and she disclosed, what would be the first thing that you'd want to do. We do evaluation through exam questions, then we have a three-year student pre- and post-survey. This is our third year, so we're going to be post-surveying the three-year students at the end of this year, so I can't wait to see how, if it changes. It's the same survey, but we'll see if their answers change. And for more information, you can email us. And endabuse.org has great materials for, and they're all free.